Good evening, friends. It's another episode of America's Most Haunted. I'm Eric Olson. I am delighted to be here with my co-author and partner in hauntedography. I just made that up. Yes, it's true. I can do that. I'm like Shakespeare. It's a neologism. And Teresa Argy is here, and we have a fantastic guest. I'll tell you, Brian, we saw more excitement ahead of this interview in terms of retweets, in terms of people jumping up and down and flopping their arms and whatnot, than we have seen ever before, and we've had some big-name guests on. So I will now introduce, and we will leave it up to Teresa, because Teresa and Brian apparently are pals. It's Brian Cano from Haunted Collector. He is the number two guy. He's that cool guy with the little ponytail, super cool, funky fresh, and we are delighted to have him. Why don't you tell us a little bit about him, Teresa?
All right. We have tonight Brian Cano from Haunted Collector. Brian is responsible for all the equipment and a wide variety of gear used during the team's investigations, including some of the cutting-edge gadgets as well as the old standbys. Mixing the old with the new is a technique that works for Brian and the team as they search for one elusive item that may be causing or contributing to the paranormal activity in each case. Brian is no stranger to the field, having been involved in urban exploration and spontaneous ghosts since in childhood. With his extensive background of fearless forging into the unknown, Brian has a blossoming and respectable career even before Haunted Collector. He's a video editor and a producer as well. Brian, an award-winning documentary filmmaker, has chronicled several of his investigations in an independent film series entitled Scared. Welcome, everyone. Brian J. Cano from Haunted Collector.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on today. Good to be here.
You know, Brian, we did have a lot of excitement for having you on, and I did get several requests for your phone number, but I graciously turned them down. So, but if you want me to pass that information on along, I will. But thank you for joining us. We're so glad that you could be on us. And this is really good timing for us, too, because tomorrow night is the season finale, correct?
It's the eve of the finale. And, wow, I mean, it's been a journey through filming it. It's been a journey watching it over these past 12, 13 weeks as our adventures are airing on TV. And I got to hand it to the editors. My life has never looked so exciting.
I think it's been a great season. I really enjoyed the first season, and I had a brief but very interesting, actually, interview with John during that first season, and that only deepened my interest and whatnot. But I think the show has really improved. I think you guys, I think the team, absolutely no issues with the team last year, but I think probably have a little more star power this year. You guys seem to work together. And just as a TV show, I think it's coming together in a more fluid manner this year. I think it's really improved a lot over what was really good before. And I think you've really risen. I think it was fairly apparent last year, but I'd say now it is very clear that you are the number two guy, and you are basically the operations guy. I think that is something that has just happened through organically, through your skills and the way that you've the way you conduct yourself on the show and the way they, as a result, present you. So congratulations on that. I think it's great stuff.
Oh, thanks, Eric. Actually, that means a lot. It's sometimes hard to gauge how things are presented because, I mean, I lived it. I was there. I kind of remembered some of the things that we would tell the producers and the director, like, hey, we have to keep this really true to the investigation. And at the same time, I'm going to be 40 in 2 years. I'm not one of the kids, per se. So, you know, it was very important to me that there was definitely a hierarchy of sorts, yet still us all being a team as far as not having too tight a title system. John's the guy in charge. We all follow him. Pretty much everything else is gravy.
Well, John's clearly kind of the moral authority, and he is the one who is kind of the rock, obviously, that it's built around. But it seems from an actual investigative standpoint, from an operational standpoint, you really do seem to be the go-to guy. Was that intended? Is that how you came into the show, or has that evolved just due to your skills?
I've been friends with John for several years, and I remember pretty much we'd go hang out with him on weekends, with myself and a good friend of mine, Chris Mancuso, who is the other half of Scared. And typically the first half hour to 45 minutes of our visits with John would be catching up on the paranormal headlines, as it were. What's the gossip? What's going on? What projects are we working on? And John kept telling me about this this show, this pilot, this thing he was working on. And we were very supportive of it. We're like, John, it's about time. America pretty much needs to see you and your way of doing things on TV, because if so many people get their knowledge from TV, as regrettable as that is, let's at least see your way of doing things. And that was pretty cool. When it got to the further stages, he called me and he says, "Hey, Bri, they need a tech guy. They need someone with gadgets. What are you doing?" And I'm like, nothing, John. I'm not really doing anything right now." So that's how that happened. I got pulled on to Haunted Collector just through my affiliation with John. And as far as how we were portrayed on the show, I think that just came organically, because, I mean, as kids, really as kids, we weren't a team that was assembled through a casting process. It's like, hey, this is John's life. This is who's in his life. Go film it. And I think the first season, it's funny because John's been on TV before. I've done work in production before. But the kids, you probably noticed, they were a little stiff that first season. Now, Chris and Amy, it's incredible how they've come out of their shells and just react naturally to the cameras being around them. And I think that definitely shows, and I think that's a big part of why this season is better. The locations are bigger, the stakes are bigger, the team is bigger, and we're all really gelling together, and can't wait to get back out on the road.
Now,
all of that makes perfect sense. I think that's a really good explanation. Yeah, and speaking of Amy, it's been really interesting to see her evolve. I remember last year she was, "Oh, no, I don't do that stuff. Sure, I'll go do some research. What do you want me to do? Just keep me out of there, Dad. I'm not going to be around when things start going bump in the night." But I don't know. We were never really given an actual explanation. But this year, she has entered the fray. I thought that was a really interesting change.
It was a reluctant change. And if you notice, towards the second half of the season, she made herself absent from the investigations. And I mean, this is really more of an Amy story for another interview, but there was one instance at St. Albans in Radford, Virginia, where one of the people that we had interviewed, one of the people that she was getting background from, told her some pretty scary things about the basement and some of the spirits and things that go on down there. And that literally freaked her out. And she's like, "Yeah, Dad, good luck in the investigation. I'll be by the phone if you need me, but not going in there, No more. No more of the nighttime investigations."
Well, I guess she dipped her toe in the waters, I suppose, huh?
She did.
Hey, what can you tell us about tomorrow's show? Can you give us any cool guy insight? Hey, I was there.
Mahalo. We were in Hawaii, which in itself was very cool. And I think the thing that really made it interesting, other than the fact that we got to go to Hawaii on Sci-Fi's dime, was the fact that the culture is different from the mainland. We had spent the past 4 months going all over the eastern seaboard. We went to some places in the Midwest. Even though accents change, the practices and the customs and the cultures for the United States is pretty much homogenous. It's pretty much the same. Like, there's little different things here and there, and every neighborhood has its own little things that make it special. But you go to Hawaii, you go 6 hours out into the middle of the ocean, and it's a completely different place. Yes, it's part of the United States, but it's so different, and they have a very rich culture that, hey, you know, we didn't exactly know how to interface with. So it took some collaboration with some local people who were there that could help us out on this case. And I think that that's one of the cool things about John. I'm constantly learning from him. He is a man who has 38 plus years of experience, but he knows when to call in help. He knows when something is beyond him. And these two cases that we have tomorrow, one of them was at an old theater. And I got to say, I think the things that we captured and that we experienced in these two places, they baffle the heck out of me, I got to tell you this. And there are things that I'm actually still struggling with. The second location, we went to the island of Lanai. Lanai, it's privately owned. I think Rupert Murdoch owned. And, we were there. And I think we explored every inch of that island. But the case we were on, very interesting. And once again, it leads me underneath a building. So go figure.
Crawling around in the dark, as Teresa wrote. I liked her description of your activities and your career on the show page, but then also on the blog there. Well, and where were you for the first? Where in Hawaii were you for the first story? The first half.
The first one was in Maui.
Ah, so Maui and Lanai. Well, that's really an interesting combination. You avoided the obvious Honolulu, Pearl Harbor connection and all that. That I am really looking forward to that personally, because we've spent a fair amount of time in Hawaii. In fact, last Thanksgiving we were on Kauai. And I picked up a couple books there, and the ghost stories, your kind of typical stuff. But, you can really tell, like you said, the culture, I mean, it really is still a very different place. And the more rural you get, which I assume Lanai is mostly, the more of the indigenous culture you pick up on. And based on what I picked up being there and certainly reading these ghost story books is, that's a culture that is very, very much in tune with the otherworldly, with the spiritual world, and that barrier is a lot more permeable there, I think, than it is on the mainland.
It was a bit of a shock, to be honest, because when we got to Maui, I was expecting, I don't know what I was expecting, I was almost expecting that typical vacation Hawaii that you see on TV. Nobody greeted us at the airport. Our first stop was Maui. There's a Walmart there. I ate at Taco Bell. Prices were not outrageous. And I'm thinking, like, what is everybody talking about? You know, that Hawaii is so different. But I'm so glad we went to Lanai, because Lanai, being its own island, its own support system, there was no modern conveniences. Not to say it was backwards, but there wasn't any fast food. It was the market, the center of the town, and it was just like two little shops that closed at 5 or 6 o'clock, and everything was really expensive. So I'm like, oh, this is what they're talking about, and I couldn't imagine surviving on that island. I don't know what I'd have to do for work, but I gotta say they've got it down, and that's just coming from a lifestyle standpoint, from a paranormal standpoint. Like I said, we really had to switch gears, because the way we normally do things, it wasn't business as usual. And John was telling us about the old island gods, there's Pele, there's all these different things that, while the modern person doesn't give it any consideration, on Hawaii, it's still very much a part of the culture and very much a part of everyday life.
Yeah, wait, I should actually go get that book, so I could give you some info on it, because I think you'd find it really fascinating. It's here. Hey, Teresa, I'd say it's your turn. Why don't you bust out some questions for Brian?
All right. Well, speaking of Hawaii, Brian, of all the locations that you've been at for this season of Haunted Collector, which one offered the most interesting challenges? Like, I know you do some private residences, you don't do some of these historical sites, but is there any one that stands out as exceedingly difficult, whether it be the location, the geography, or the people that you had to deal with, what sticks out in your mind is a little more challenging than the rest?
Oof, that's a tough one. We had 12 episodes this year, so that's 24 cases. It was roughly half and half between residential and non-residential cases. And I think they were all challenging in that we only had 3 or 4 days at each location to try and figure out what was going on. And it's funny because, you know, 3 or 4 days might seem like a long time, but it's not. You know, we're really under the gun. And we get a lot of, actually I wouldn't say a lot, we get some criticism online where people say, oh, isn't it convenient that Brian went right to the item? And I'm thinking, I'm like, well, if they had kept everything in, it would be a 16-hour show, and everybody would turn off. So the challenge of it each and every time is always, all right, guys, battle stations. We've got to get to the bottom of this. We have to be quick. We have to be efficient, and we have to be sensitive to the people who live here or work here, because, you know what, once we leave, they're still here. So we can't go provoking. We can't go carrying on in a manner that would make things worse.
Chosen the wrong item, like if you remove one item, because sometimes some of those places are so filled with antiques, I would be overwhelmed. I walk into cases like that where there's nothing but antiques in the house. Have you ever worried, like, maybe this isn't the right item that we're taking away? When you guys were at the tavern where the baby was crying with Mr. Drinkwater, and it seemed like, was it the knife? Was it the baby rattle? It seemed like it could have been so many different things. Do you ever wonder, did I take the right thing, or maybe I should have taken both things, or has a client ever called you back and said, come back and get this other thing?
I rely on John very heavily for that. I mean, he's been the collector for pretty much his entire career. So
I am a haunted collector.
I am a haunted collector.
good accent. We love that accent. It's so funny.
So he's the guy who ultimately is going to make the decision. We'll bring him everything we found. I mean, personally, I have to come to it from a scientific aspect. I have to follow the evidence. And there never is a case where we're 100% sure. And that's why he says, hey, what do you want to do with this? You know, what do you want me to do with this item? And there have been times where we'll remove an item and activity will continue. In that case, you know, there'll be follow-up with either a local group, or if it's a local toss, you know, Don follows up and more steps are taken to fix it. In some cases, items have gone back because it's like, you know what? All right, this wasn't the item. Hey, take it. It's yours. You know, everything stays in the possession of the people who own it. John just removes it. And I think it's one of those things where a lot of viewers see the money aspect, and they kind of fail to see the, hey, this is a problem. People don't want to be reminded of things that cause them pain, that cause them anguish. And you know, they're just looking at a dollar figure, and they're like, yeah, those people don't care about that. They care about getting their lives back in order. And
well, it's not as though it's his to sell. He's just sequestering it, essentially, right?
Yeah, it goes to the museum, and it's not like he's cashing in on it.
Right. That's funny that people think that way. That wouldn't be the part that would occur to me. I would be concerned about housing all of that, you know. My goodness, I pictured the scene in Ghostbusters where the containment facility blows, you know. Oh man, I don't want to see the Statue of Liberty walking down the street, you know, toward me as a result.
Brian, do you do any sort of protection or I don't know what your spirituality is, but do you do anything before you go on an investigation, like to protect? I know that when you're with scared, you incorporate psychics into your investigation, which I love the whole process that you do with scared, actually. It's completely different from Haunted Collector, but I think it's brilliant. But do you personally do anything to protect yourself physically or spiritually when you go into an investigation or when you go into a case that you think might have some activity, or do you just kind of trust your instincts when you go in?
I think it depends on the case. If it's something that's just basic activity and it's not really looking like it's going to be a darker case, I often find myself not. But if it's something that we go in and John feels there might be some practicing going on or something dark or possibly even demonic, you know, absolutely, I will protect myself in my own way. I'm not a religious person, but I'm becoming a spiritual person. And it's one of those things that as the years go by, my logical scientific mind is trying to allow for that without too much of a schism. But I think the two go hand in hand, and it's one of those things where I can never say this will work or that will work. And let's be honest, when investigating the paranormal, there is no piece of armor that you can wear that will protect you against everything. It just doesn't exist. So if you do the work, from time to time, you will get burned. But I think as long as you're careful, you use your common sense, and you don't take it, you're not flipping about it, you'll be in a much better position to go home and not be followed and not have negative repercussions.
I think that is a tremendous point. From what I have gathered, and as Teresa knows, I am only in the barest sense, the really only real and official investigation I've been on was with her. I've been to places. The first chapter of our book, the chapter that we had to write in order to turn in the proposal, is on the Ohio State Reformatory in Mansfield. And so, you know, I've been there now a few times and have certainly spent time and took a tour by myself when there was no one else around, and that was very interesting and all. But what I have learned, what I've gathered, kind of a common theme of successful investigators is a matter of attitude. And what you said about not being flippant, that to me seems really crucial. From the outside, you know, a lot of people would just think that that's something in passing. But it seems to me your attitude and how you approach it really is critical to both your success as an investigator, but then to your personal safety.
Absolutely. It's almost like, you know, like they say, what you put out there is what you'll get back. And don't get me wrong, we joke around on the set. There's time for fun, but when it comes time to investigate, it's business. And we all kind of settle and approach it very methodically. And it's funny because sometimes the producers or the director will get frustrated with us and especially with Chris Zaffis, me and him, we're this team, we're the unit, and actually now Jason Gates is part of that unit. And when something happens, when we encounter something on a case, or you know, we're in a basement or we're up in an attic, and something happens, we hear a noise or something big happens, we often don't react. And they'll be like, "Did you hear that?" I'm like, "Yeah, we heard that. Let's go find out where it came from." And they're like, "Well, aren't you afraid?" I'm like, "No. I'm going to get to the bottom of this, but don't you worry. But, you know, no, I'm not afraid." And obviously, for entertainment value, they want us to be scared. They want us to be looking around going, "Oh, my God." But we're not like that. And funny, because sometimes because of that, you know, every now and then I'll go online and I'll read what people say, and they're like, "Oh, these people are the worst actors ever." And I'm like, "No, we're really not.
That is so funny.
We don't jump in."
That's a compliment, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, we are the worst actors ever. So,
Thank you,
sir.
That is funny.
And scene.
That reminds me of a scene from one of my favorite movies, Night Shift. I don't even know if you remember that.
Is that Henry Winkler?
It is Henry Winkler. And a very, very young Michael Keaton, and they become pimps out of the morgue. And apropos of nothing, It's just the idiot nephew of the boss is watching TV, and he's watching the Flintstones, and he's cracking up hysterically watching the Flintstones, and he says, "Barney Rubble, what an actor." That's what it reminds me of. I don't know why. Hey, I found the book while you were chatting, and I think you'll find it really interesting. It's called Hawaii's Best Spooky Tales, and there's a series of them, but they're all collected by this guy named Rick Carroll. And I thought I remembered a story from this particular one that I have, Hawaii's Best Spooky Tales. The original, by the way, is the subtitle, from Lanai. And I found it, and it's called The Valley of Ghosts. Did you hear anything about or find The Valley of Ghosts? Did that come up in your travels there?
Lanai was very small, and I think we've been to almost every corner, because it seems like there's two roads. You can either go east and west or north and south. And during our downtime, May, Chris, and Jason took the Jeeps into some pretty dusty, barren areas. We went to the Garden of the Gods, which looks like the landscape of Mars. It's amazing. We came back with so much red dust on us. You know, it's like we were in Total Recall or something. Another place was Shipwreck Cove, which was very much like Lost, which was cool because we're all very big J.J. Abrams fans. Lots of areas on there. I'm not sure if there was a Valley of the Ghosts, but on Maui, we did some poking around the Iao Valley, which is a very spiritual place, and you can definitely feel it there.
Well, if you get a chance and you run into that book, do just because you have your Lanai experience, do check out the story called The Valley of Ghosts. It's really quite interesting. I won't dwell on it too much, but in ancient Hawaii, in a pre-Christian Hawaii, Lanai was known as the Island of the Ghosts, and in fact, it wasn't even inhabited by people until the 15th century because they were so afraid of it.
Yes, absolutely. One of the things that we had to contend with on the case on Lanai was, this is horrible, I don't remember the name, but I think they were the Night Walkers or the Night Stalkers.
Night Walkers.
The Night Walkers.
Oh, that's creepy.
Yeah, they were supposedly, their path led through the grounds of the house we were at. And there was
That's it all throughout this book.
Supposedly,
yep, go ahead.
If they came upon you, I think you had to lay down or literally strip down just so that they wouldn't see you.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever it was, if they saw you, almost very Medusa-like, you know, you would die. If they became aware of you and you saw them and they saw you, it wasn't a good thing. And, you know, we kind of poked around for them. I can't say I wasn't a little creeped out by it, but obviously I'm talking to you, so they didn't get me.
Brian, did you
maybe
know the difference in the culture of Hawaii? Because it is part of the United States, but honestly, it's like its own country. And I've noticed, even just talking to relatives of mine who are from Ireland and friends that I have that live in Romania, just the cultural differences in their nationality and in Hawaii, since it is such a different culture there. Is their belief system different? Did you find it different as far as their attitude towards spirits and the afterlife and ghosts? I mean, just the story of the Nightwalkers, I remember seeing a program on it on the History Channel, and it was like a darker side of Hawaii I'd never thought of. But did you encounter a different approach to the paranormal while you were in Hawaii?
The approach is similar, but the attitude is different, where as here on the mainland, there's this brimming skepticism about everything. It's almost like a tug of war between believers and skeptics, and it's always a debate. In Hawaii, less so. It seems like everyone is very comfortable with it because it is part of their culture. It is part of how they were raised and have grown up and just live day to day. It's almost where here we consider it, for many, it's a hobby. Oh, you're into the paranormal too. Oh, so am I. No, it's like air. It's like food. Yes, I breathe it and I have it. It's part of my day. and that's very much how it is in Hawaii. The spiritual side of things is part of their everyday life, so it's not a surprise. It's not something they're fearful of, unless it is something to be feared, like the Nightwalkers. And also on Lanai, one of the items that came under investigation, because, you know, going in, we have like a short list of things that we're going to really check out. One of them was something called a Fiji fork. This was allegedly used by cannibals to feed on other humans.
Oh, those things, those big, giant fork-looking things?
It's a big wooden thing. But it's very ornate, and I don't think it was your run-of-the-mill, like, hey, let's go down and eat some people today. It was almost a ritualistic thing.
Well, in most cannibal cultures, it isn't so much a nutritional matter anyway. It is a ritualistic matter. It's
chicken
very much
for people.
Yes, exactly. It is a means of absorbing their power. That's essentially what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, wow, that's super extra special creepy, I would say. The other thing about traditional Hawaiian culture, the native Hawaiian culture, it is was a ancestor worshiping culture and religion. And so as a result, the spirits take on a very personal meaning. Mm-hmm. They're not just sort of random arbitrary things. They're, you know, Uncle Joe.
Well, that's what I like about in general this season of Collector, because, I mean, that has parallels with Native Americans, where it's very ancestors are revered, respected, and are still very much part of the pantheon of their spirits, in addition to animal spirits. And, you know, in another episode during the season at a place called Jordan Springs, we had to call in a local shaman to deal with something that we were clearly out of our league. We came across a fetish doll, and John didn't want us to touch it, go near it, or anything, because it was created with a specific purpose of attracting and perpetuating this negative energy. Why? We don't know. I mean, we may never know why. But the physical evidence of this fetish doll being there, and then things that happened in Hawaii, it seems like everywhere we went, they allow John to show more of the process. It's just not go in, grab an item, and leave. There was a bookstore in Tip City, Ohio, where we couldn't pinpoint one specific item. There's just too much in there. There's too much going on. So John suggested, okay, I'm going to give you a method on how to reduce some of the activity around here, to break up some of that energy that's bouncing around in here. And he told her to take mirrors and put them by the windows and put crystals in every corner of the bookstore. So it's not all gear and gadgets. It's almost like you have to take the spiritual side, the metaphysical side, tie it in with some scientific method, and through all these things we're arriving at a solution.
Yeah, I think that's the best method to approach a paranormal investigating. I've been doing it for a while, and I think what I like about Haunted Collector is it does show a different side of things, and it does show a different process. And now jumping off that subject for just a moment and talking about Scared, if anybody is not familiar with Scared and their documentaries, you got to go to the website and check them out. I love the fact that you incorporate, and you do this on the show as well, the old school techniques and the new school techniques, that you employ a psychic, but you're also coming at it from a scientific point of view. The episode you did at the Grand Midway, and you had John Zaffis was there and Rosemary Ellen Guiley, and you were using all sorts of different stuff, and I thought that was just fabulous. And I liked what you said, what you were talking about, the spirit box. And people, because we use them. I mean, we have a shack hack, and I don't know a paranormal team that doesn't use them. But when people use these things to communicate, they don't know who they're communicating with. Who do you know you're communicating with? Just because you want to talk to the madam who might have been supposedly at this location, you don't know who you're talking to, and people have a very flippant attitude about it sometimes.
It's not a toy. Everything we use, we're using almost at our own risk. I was at a convention one time, and they had broken up the people into groups, and there was the attendees, and then there was the people who were hosting each location. And at one particular location that I was assigned to, someone else's daughter was also assigned to that location, and she turns on the spirit box, and she just starts yelling and just really irresponsibly using the item. And it's one of those things where I'm fine with people's particular methods. I'm fine with trying different things. But she's crossing over spirits, and she's talking to demons, and it's like, really? You're joking around with this, or you think you're being serious, but you need to come at this with a level of respect. Like, literally, it's almost like, and I equate it to the scientists who first began experimenting with radioactive isotopes. Hey, they think this is great. It's going to create power and cure disease and do this. And, oh, we radiated. We're all radiated and we got cancer. Damn, we didn't know.
Right. The whole idea of spirit rescue, and I personally think that it's kind of arrogant to think that we as living humans have the power to make any spirit go anywhere if it doesn't want to go. But
I'm personally with you on that. I would never have the hubris to say I rescued a spirit, but to those who do it or think they do it, hey, more power to you.
And especially
I'm not gonna judge.
Yeah, especially as just a paranormal investigator, I am not a psychic, so I don't know. I mean, I might say, you know, we asked the spirit to leave, so now your house is clean. I don't know. I mean, if I have a psychic that I trust, I could ask them. But I used to think that it was my job as a paranormal investigator to get rid of spirits, like a ghost maid. Like, you go into a residential case, and you try to rid the residents of a ghost. And now it's been
just
years and years.
Just the name of the alone.
Yeah, well, my attitude changed. I don't believe that I have that kind of ability or power to do that anyway. But I come across it, my team that I work with, we are just looking for validation and answers and trying to find out who's there and if they have a message or whatever. We don't even really care about documenting evidence. We're more about validating experiences. But I think it's if you don't have a psychic, how do you know? I mean, how arrogant of you to think that you have the power of God that you can cross over a spirit and cleanse a house. And I think TV is a bad attitude.
I'm glad you brought up my home team scared. It's something that I kind of wish we could incorporate a little more on Collector, but we operate under what we call the three-pillar system. Skeptic, scientist, psychic. Three different viewpoints, all slightly different. It's like checks and balances. So the funny thing about this is that we've never really agreed on anything, and I think that's the way it should be, with the exception of one place, the Grand Midway Hotel, and you saw this location on Haunted Collector. We had done that documentary that you mentioned a couple of years prior, and that was the one and only time that the three pillars of our group left a place in complete agreement as to what was there. And that was very much a shared personal experience between us. It was something very altering for us. I mean, Chris, who is our skeptic, became less so. He became very much a believer there. He's still a skeptical believer, but it's one of those things that when confronted with something malevolent, you really start thinking about those big picture things, good and evil and whatnot. And if there's evil, there must be good. So you got to pick a side. And he now wears a cross because he kind of feels that. And then now that door has been opened, he can't close it again. And hey, this is his allegiance. You know, we're gonna try to do things the right way for the right reasons.
You know, it's not very PC to throw in your lot with Satan. You know,
that episode
it's frowned upon in polite society.
But
hey, we have a caller who's been on hold, I guess, kind of the whole show. So Why don't we try to get a hold of them? Caller from area code 860, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you for holding for so long. Sorry about that. Do you have a...
Oh, that's okay. It was very...
What's your name, and do you have a question for Brian?
Yes, I do. My name is Christine, and I have a question for Brian. I'd like to know, with your Scared project, do you plan on doing anything, say, international?
Whew, Scared International, that would be very cool.
Well, because, you know, it's like thousands of years old over there in Europe and, per se, the world, other than
it's
just
It's also
USA.
Thousands of dollars to get there.
Well, I thought, you know, hey.
Scared is out of pocket. It's all our... It's edited with love. It's something that we do, that we love doing for ourselves. It was never meant to get on TV. It was never meant to be anything other than a series of independent documentaries. So if you know a way to get us to Europe,
I'd
cheaply,
love to go with you.
We will take you with us.
I would love to go. Another question. What was I going to ask?
By the way, all those sirens,
I know, I was out on my
back
porch.
Which of us is drawing those?
I was on hold for so long, I took my dog out, and then all of a sudden all the sirens were coming down. Sorry. what was I going
to
say?
I thought I might have been the Ghostbusters.
But I loved in the interview how you said, you know, from a scientific point of view, you were just like, you didn't know, and now you're leaning more towards the spiritual, which is great.
I definitely think it's one of those things that...
I mean, you are directly a scientist. I mean, just watching you
yes.
on TV or whatever. And to have you
that,
say that...
It was something that when I was a skeptic, I started out coming into the paranormal 10 years ago as a skeptic. I didn't believe in anything. I said, no, there's nothing. We're deluding ourselves. We just want to make sure that Granny's in a good place. yeah, there's nothing. But as I read more, learned more... mentored under some people and just really got out there and did it, you know, it didn't add up. And, you know, like I said before, once the door
amazing.
Is open, you can never quite close it again. So I figured, all right, I'm not going to try to close it. I'm going to open it. I'm going to stand in the doorway and I'm going to look. I'm going to look around and see what there is to see.
Was there like one specific time in your life where you just said, hey, you know, this is where I want to go. This is what I want to do to be a paranormal investigator?
I feel that my life has been a river of sorts that has carried me where it will. I'm very much a person who doesn't like to believe in fate because I feel like I need to be in control of my destiny. But I feel like where I'm at right now, I was pretty much delivered to. So I could rage against the concept, but it's here I am.
That's right. You are there for a reason, you know, and you're showing the world, and that's kudos to you.
There is nothing wrong with some well-placed internal contradictions.
Well, that's true. That's true. But anyway, Brian, I am your friend from Facebook. I live in Connecticut, and I was just wondering, are you coming this way?
It's anything is possible.
Yeah, because you guys have been here. Like that Enfield show, that was on before. I've
mm-hmm.
seen it before. And anything ever really come from that?
That
case
particular couple, they were on, I believe, The Haunted before that. And I didn't know that until everyone online told me last week. And I'm like, really?
Okay. I know, isn't it? Yeah, because I was watching. I'm like, wait a minute, man. I remember those people. It was pretty funny.
And their little doggies, their poor little doggies, and their bunny. Wasn't it they have a bunny and a doggie that passed away? When they were on that,
like people hemorrhaged in the house, and there was a guy who killed the lady down the street and her husband. I mean, it was pretty scary.
There was a lot of stuff that went on in that house, and a lot of it didn't make it to the air because they're kind of dead ends. So,
but you are quite
actually.
The traveler. You have to make it to Europe and all those other places.
One thing that didn't make it to air that I'm kind of glad it didn't because it was really tense. They did show the luminol test, Chris and I spraying the floor.
I remember.
In order to test it, we need a blood sample. So, okay, nicked Chris's finger, made sure that the compound was working. Now, just to set this up, we were filming back in March. It was Good Friday. Now, I wasn't aware of the couple's history on The Haunted. I didn't see the episode. I only knew little bits and pieces because we hadn't been, Amy hadn't finished all her research yet. So I'm just doing my science thing. Hey, let's test for blood. John comes out and he goes, wait a minute, they just told me you did a luminol test. I'm like, yeah, it's, you didn't find any blood. It's fine. Don't worry about it. He's like, you did a luminol test. I'm like, yeah. John, what's the matter? He goes, you spilled blood in a possible demonic location on Good Friday under a full moon? I was like, what, John? What?
No one followed you home storm.
No one followed you home that night.
And he said, who told you to do this? Which one of them told you to do this? I'm like, nobody. I wanted to do this. John, it's a scientific method. He's like, how could you do this?
So there are a lot of things. Yeah, that you still don't know that John is your mentor. He's the one, you know. That's kind of cool. But I'm glad nobody followed you home.
John is the Obi-Wan Kenobi to my Anakin Skywalker, which means one of these days he will knock me into a volcano, which I'm glad didn't happen.
But I remember seeing John Zaffis on the original Ghost Hunters when they first started years ago. I think 8, 9 years ago now. Yeah, and I remember them bringing him in. And then
I wish more people would remember that.
Yeah, and well, because I've been, you know, the paranormal all my life. I mean, my mother was a psychic, so I was the type of person that you had to see to believe. And when I started seeing things as a kid, it was like, really? You know, you kind of try to deny that, but it's there. So that's
well,
why
Christine,
what you said.
Wonderful
kind of like
conversation.
What you said.
We really appreciate the questions.
Okay.
Fantastic. We need to press on because, man, these shows go fast. We're down to our final 14 minutes. Thanks
for
calling.
Okay, bye-bye.
Have fun with the doggy out there.
Bye.
Bye.
She kind of brings up an interesting point. Like, I wish that the shows and the people who enjoy the shows wouldn't set up camps so much. So I remember in the first season, everyone was like, oh, Ghost Hunters is better. And I'm thinking, like, John trained Jason Grant. John trained Zach. John trained Ryan. Hey, we're all working together. Like, there's no need for the who's better than who. We're all doing the work. So I like them all, you know?
I couldn't agree more. It's really funny when you are online, of course, and I think it's more the younger, probably, typically it's your younger crowd. But, yeah, you know, the people really do vehemently take sides, and I agree with you. It's more like a spectrum. You're just seeing different approaches, different emphasis. You know, it's all the many colors of the rainbow. It's a UN. It's a paranormal UN. Can't we all just get along?
That's a good way of putting it. I love when people go and fly the flag for paranormal unity, because I'm not about unity. I'm about community. And every family has the strange uncle that is kind of weird, but he's part of your family. And I don't know, we might be that strange uncle, so I'm not exactly sure where this analogy is going.
In the non-TV community that I work in the paranormal unity is this big push. And if you've ever met people that work in the paranormal that are not on TV that say that they don't want to be on TV, which they all lie, there's no such thing as paranormal unity. It's like a unicorn. It's a nice idea, but it doesn't.
Oh, yeah.
Everyone
Absolutely.
Is so
confused. I agree.
And so cutthroat and out to trash each other, it's terrible. In fact, the people that I've met that do work on TV get along 1,000 times better than the people like me, not me personally, but the people that I know that work out here. It's ridiculous. And they all, like you said, they choose camps. They take sides, and maybe because this one started first, or this one does it this way, and then they copy exactly what they see on TV instead of forging their own way, which is what I like. What you do with Scared is different than what you do on Haunted Collector, and I like it both. I think it's great. I love the fact that in the one episode of Scared when where were you? The Middleborough Town Hall. You had the psychic. You were doing card readings. You were doing the spirit box and automatic writing. All that, all those techniques. Try everything. See what works. Keep trying.
Yeah.
I think that's great. I think it's great. I think that the people who actually are the most highly noted in the community are the only ones that are really getting along, not so much the people who are like, no, that's our building. You can't investigate there.
Yeah.
That's our home place.
And they're shooting up. They're shooting a pilot, and they're ordering T-shirts, and yeah.
Well,
no,
that's all you need, right, Brian? A black T-shirt and a business card, right? And you're a paranormal.
Yeah. We could do an entire show just on that pet peeve. But
Brian, you guys brought up kind of an interesting point where you were talking about kind of the evolution of your perspective, your worldview, I suppose, and how the paranormal fits into that. As a someone who started as a skeptic and someone who definitely applies the scientific method, and by the way, as Teresa said, I love that blend of the old school and the new school, and I saw you do something with it was where you were, I don't know, using dust or something. I mean, it was just literally
baby powder.
Baby powder. That's what it was. I thought that was brilliant, you know. That was the solution to that problem. You know, you don't bring a elephant gun, you know, to on a mouse hunt. You know, you use what works. So, but anyway, what I'm really interested in, and I try to remember to get around to, you know, to asking the investigators who we talk to, is what do you see now, clearly it is something that appears to be evolving, but what really is your sort of worldview in terms of if, in fact, there is something to the paranormal, anything at all, if it's 1% of reports, if it's 0.0001, whatever that number is, as long as that number is not zero, what does that represent to you? And a corollary of that, I suppose, is if it's a form of energy, what form of energy is it in your mind?
The way I look at the paranormal is the way I look at the world in general. It's all part of the same ecosystem, all part of the same organism. The paranormal is not unusual. It's not odd or strange. We just don't understand it, so therefore it's strange to us. Everything that's happening is probably functioning exactly as it should. So if there's a spirit trap somewhere, you know what? It's not an aberration. It's supposed to be happening, and that's just part of what's going on. My role in this, that I feel that I'm positioned to do, I'm not looking to disprove it. I'm not looking to prove it. I'm looking to measure it. I want to quantify it. I want to get that empirical data that will bring this from being a hedge pseudoscience into being, part of our understanding. Like, okay, water goes from a liquid to a solid at 32 degrees Fahrenheit. We know this. We didn't always know it, and ooh, it's strange. It's changing shape. And, you know, we've gotten numbers assigned to as much as we understand. We don't have that for the paranormal yet. So I kind of feel like my focus is trying to bring that into an empirical reality. And as far as what is the paranormal, that's what we're all trying to figure out. And I don't look at it from the skeptic's eye anymore. I believe it is part of the fabric of everything. It's the reports that I don't always believe. It's people that I'm skeptical of. Now, you could tell me, oh, my God, I just saw 50 demons in my kitchen. I go, okay. All right. Men in the little white suits are coming to get you, but I don't disbelieve in the phenomenon. I'm skeptical of the reports of it because it is perspective. It is our own personal perspective, and sometimes that can be skewed.
Well, that makes good sense. As far as that, taking it just one step farther then, I mean, do you see the eventual, hopefully, coming understanding involving some different or new form of energy that we just haven't been able to quantify yet? Or am I putting words in your mouth?
I think down the road, we'll have a better understanding of it. And just like hundreds of years ago, thousands of years ago, we believed the Earth was the center of the universe. Now we know the center of the galaxy. Now we know in our solar system, that's the sun. We go around the sun. We also thought the Earth was flat. Wrong. It's spherical. We know that now. Everything that we quote-unquote know about the paranormal is akin to that flat world view. We're just scratching the surface. And eventually, we will understand things about it. I'll be able to go to you, like, who knows, three generations down, we'll be able to go, okay, well, when you have a concentration of 25.3 milligauss per square inch, that's a spirit manifestation. A number. We know this. We don't know that now. But even if we know it then, there's always going to be something that baffles us. That's just human nature. We're constantly, you know, looking. We're constantly searching. And we're never going to know it all. We're just going to move on to the next mystery.
Well, that's a darn good response. I like that.
Well,
yeah, I mean, that doesn't even, I didn't even really address the issue of, you know, and then what does it mean? Because that's a whole different set of things. You know, we have people who, you know, whose metaphysics, people who agree on quote-unquote objective data, scientific method, et cetera, who still have completely different worldviews on what does it mean? You know, what is the meaning of all this?
Oh, yeah.
So that's absolutely never going to be resolved.
As long as there are varying opinions, I mean, I think there should be different viewpoints. There should never, ever be one way of thought. Now, here's something that I anyone who knows me has heard this a million times, and I invite the listeners out there to go along with this with me. Okay, and I could ask you, is the glass half empty or half full?
Both.
Why?
Because it's those questions, that dichotomy, that's a false dichotomy. You're being asked to select a point of view, whereas the universal point of view would see that it's it is half of the material, half of the space is taken up. So it's neither, it's both, and it's neither, because it's really just a question of it's a false dichotomy.
You're going I like where you're going. It's big. It's almost the Schrodinger's cat view. I'm going to put that on pause. Teresa, what's your answer, half full or half empty?
I think it's half full.
Why?
Because I think there's so much more that we don't know about, that we can know about, that we don't see, that we can't touch. I think that we've only scratched the surface of even what it is to be human, to be here, let alone to know what's beyond here.
Okay, that's a good answer. I will give you the correct answer, and this is an answer free of ego, because it's neither something I believe nor something that I need to prove. Now, this is the thing that I like to try to get the new investigators to really wrap their head around, because like you said, Eric, perspective, you know, depending on what perspective you come at, it could be either half full or half empty, and you'd both be right. The only fact about that question is there's water in the glass. That is it. That is the only fact. Half full or half empty, irrelevant. The facts, the evidence, is there's water in the glass.
Woo-hoo.
And that's all you can go on. That's all you got.
I like that. You're a deep thinker and a deep drinker of water. I'll always rhyme if I can, you know. That is, you know what? I'm not even going to try to respond. I'm going to put that in its appropriate place, and I am going to dwell and ponder upon that, because I think that is some wisdom right there, young man.
If you apply it to the paranormal investigations, you know, we get EVPs all the time of these random sounds, and you'll get people who are going, oh, it's a ghost, it's my mother's brother's aunt. And you get other people who are like, no, it's the train passing outside. No, it's a noise. What is it? Perspective. And that's not to invalidate or say that anything people are doing is wrong or, hey, you're wasting your time. It's just I think people need to almost take a step back and understand that the only facts are the facts, and you have to see them for what they are, and then maybe see what we're going to do with it from there.
Well, that is about as neat a way to wrap the show as I know of. That is so funny. And I know you planned it all. You probably plotted every moment of the show out just to arrive at that point with 1 minute left to go. You are an amazing individual. All right, well, we are going to wrap things up. Thanks so much, Brian. This hour, I always say this, the hour always goes so fast, but this one went even faster than usual. What a pleasure to talk with you. Really enjoyed getting your perspective on things, and very, very level-headed without being cynical, you know, and it's amazing, I think, that you've arrived at this point and still sort of seeing life as open-ended and the possibilities as spanning in a panorama before us, and yet you're approaching it in a very scientific and step-by-step and level-headed manner. I think that is as good approach as any, and better than most. What do you think, Teresa?
Absolutely, Brian. It's been a pleasure to talk to you. I wish we could talk more. I wanted to hear more about Scared's Adventures at the Knickerbocker, because we cover that in our book as well, but we'll talk about that offline, I guess, and have you back on the show.
Sounds good.
When that documentary is ready. But thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure. Everyone tune in tomorrow night and see the season finale of Haunted Collector.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Brian. Really, really enjoyed it. And only the best to you. And, maybe you should have your own show one of these days.
Hey, from your mouth to the ears of the universe, who knows?
Who knows? All right, have a great evening. Thanks, Teresa.
Hi, everyone.
We'll talk soon. Good night.
Take care.
Good night.